Blog Talk Radio.
And welcome, my true crime friends. I'm off to a flying start. It's Web Sleuth Radio on Blog Talk. My name is Tricia Griffith, the very proud owner of WebSleuth.com. My producer, Bessie, she is our administrator at Web Sleuth. And tonight we have a guest that is the guy you want to get stuck with somewhere for like a year, because he can talk true crime nonstop. He knows everything, all the stuff that we're interested in as far as true crime. Our next guest has the answers, or at least he can offer up several answers. We can choose from what he says. I'd like to welcome Dr. Scott Bond. He's a criminologist and professor at Drew University, also author of the book Why We Love Serial Killers, The Curious Appeal of the World's Most Savage Murderers. And Dr. Bond, welcome to Web Sleuth Radio. We really appreciate you taking the time out.
Well, thank you so much. It's great to be here this evening.
I want to warn everybody, since I am doing this podcast from my home, I have three dogs here. If they hear a door slam 400 miles away, they will start barking. So please just bear with me if it sounds all of a sudden like we're in a kennel and a bomb went off. It's just my dogs, and they'll calm down shortly. Dr. Bond, you do so many things. You're a professor at Drew University. You also have this great blog that you write for Psychology Today, and that's called Wicked Deeds, correct?
That's correct, yes, Wicked Deeds. It's a blog that I write. Yeah. What was your question?
Oh, please continue. No, just please continue. No. Tell us about the blog.
Well, I was just going to say, I write on a variety of crime topics, most of them involving violent crime. And, of course, since I've written quite a bit about serial killers, not surprisingly, I have quite a few articles about that. But I also touch on things like white-collar crime, gang-related crime, even drug-related crimes and overdoses and et cetera, which are, unfortunately so much in the news now with the proliferation of opiates and so forth. So I touch on a lot of different topics that I think, hopefully people who are interested in true crime will really enjoy.
Let me tell you, I can guarantee they'll enjoy. This blog is absolutely fantastic. And you tweet it out a lot, and that's how I always catch it, is at your tweet. So if you're on Twitter, the handle is Doc Bond, right? D-O-C-K-B-O-N-N. Okay.
D-O-C-B-O-N-N.
Right. It's definitely something you need to check out, Wicked Deeds at Psychology Today. Also, I know why I got into true crime, because I'm just kind of twisted, and I just find these things fascinating, even though they're horrible and awful. But you have taken it to another level. You are a professional. You're a doctor. You're a professor. What got you into this whole topic in your life?
Well, that's a very interesting question, and I have always been interested in the macabre and sort of the dark side of the human condition ever since I was a kid. And like a lot of kids, I was originally fascinated by monster movies and horror films, that kind of thing. And along the way, I just developed this interest in sort of extreme types of crime, especially serial killers and violent criminals and so forth. And it's just carried with me for a lifetime. And really, as a profession and as a college professor, this has really been the last 15 to 20 years of my career. I spent the first almost 20 years of my professional career working in the television and entertainment field. And it was really in that arena where I realized that crime is an entertainment commodity. And whether it's fictionalized crime or whether it is true crime, people just love to tune in. They're fixated on this stuff. And I worked at NBC for a number of years, and I could see firsthand how when there was a grisly crime story in the news, the ratings would go up. People just, would tune in. So I realized that it really is, a form of entertainment, even though it may be, quite grisly. People can't get enough of this stuff. And then about nearly 20 years ago now, I just decided to leave the television and entertainment field and get a PhD in criminology and pursue this as a, you know, as a profession. And I'm really glad that I did. I love it. And so it's been a, just sort of a lifelong interest. And I think it's a lifelong interest that a lot of us can relate to, probably many of your listeners to this show. I wouldn't be surprised if they've had an interest, you know, for much of their lives.
Oh, absolutely. And we will all admit that we are interested in true crime, although we don't want it to happen. It's not like we're rooting for the bad guys here. Just there's mm-hmm. so much of it to choose from. If we could wipe it out somehow, everybody would be very happy and we'd find something else to do. But unfortunately, there's just way too much of, like you said, Dr. Bond, the grisly that's out there. Let's talk about the book. This book mm-hmm. is deeply researched. I have to tell you, I was listening to it. I purchased it on audio. And I'm listening, and I'm on the edge of my seat, and I realize that was just the foreword. I was listening to the foreword, and I'm like, God, this is great. And the book is even more amazing. I haven't finished it, but I'm going to finish it tonight. What started this book? How did it happen?
Well, it was several years in the making, and I just decided to write a book that, for lack of a better way of describing it, everything you always wanted to know about serial killers but were afraid to ask. And I approached it from the standpoint of, if I, let's say I had a casual interest or even more than a casual interest in serial killers, but I wanted to go to one book and really just immerse myself in it, learn as much as I could, but do so in one book. That's the book I tried to write. And it looks at serial killers in terms of their motivations, and the motivations vary from one serial killer to another. It puts it in perspective in terms of how many serial killers are out there and how much of the murder equation they really comprise. So it's filled with facts and information, but it's also presented, I think, hopefully in a very entertaining way. And then I went up close and personal with two serial killers, those being David Berkowitz, who called himself the Son of Sam, and Dennis Rader, who called himself Bind, Torture, Kill, or BTK, for the true crime fans out there who know of BTK. And I spent considerable time writing, corresponding, and also interviewing both of these individuals, who are thankfully locked up now, and to get inside of their minds and really try to deconstruct them and understand their motivations to add some real life perspective, real life serial killer life perspective to my book. And then the last component of my book is where I sort of take the mirror, if you will, and turn it away from the serial killer and put it on ourselves and say, why, in fact, are we, the public, so fascinated by these individuals? So I do sort of a social psychological analysis of you know, the fascination of the public with the dark side. And so you put that all together, and you've got this book, Why We Love Serial Killers.
And we're going to get into the why of Why We Love Serial Killers in just a little bit, but I'd like to talk about Dennis Rader, Bind, Torture, Kill, BTK. There have mm-hmm. been conflicting reports, if you will, because it had always kind of been the theory that a serial killer mm-hmm. doesn't stop unless they're dead or in prison, in jail. He
mm-hmm.
stopped.
Mm-hmm.
He stopped for a long time. Do you have any idea why?
Well, he didn't. I wouldn't say that he stopped. What he had was very, very long cooling off periods, which is what they're referred to, in between his murders. In the case, some cases, months and even years. But he never really stopped. In fact, when he was finally caught after 30 years, it took them 30 years to catch him, he was planning his next murder. So it's not that he really stopped. He is a bit of an aberration among serial killers in that he would have these really, really lengthy cooling off periods. Now, I asked him the question, how and why was this so? Because most serial killers, it's the cooling off period between murders is much shorter. It's weeks,
months,
maybe
days,
a couple
yeah.
of months. Yeah, if not days, exactly. And here's what he told me. He developed a technique, if you will. It's a rather disgusting technique, but he would relive his crimes through a combination of fantasy, mental visualization, and then dressing up dolls and cutouts in all of his trophies and memorabilia that he collected from his victims. So he would relive these experiences, work himself up into an emotional and sexual high, and relieve himself of this need to kill again. And sometimes he was able to do this for, as I said, months and years at a time, and get the fix that he needed, to put it in like the analogy of a drug, a fix, because it really is like a fix, a high. And then not have to kill again for some period of time. And because Dennis is a sociopath, or excuse me, I would say he's a psychopath, not a sociopath. There is a difference, which I can elaborate on.
We'll get into that too, right.
Yeah. He's a psychopath. So consequently, he has this all rationalized that we, the public, should be grateful that he developed this technique. Otherwise, he might have had to kill a lot more people than he did. So we, therefore, should be grateful in his disturbed mind.
Next time you talk to him, just say that, hey, thank you, Dennis, for being so gracious and learning
how to live out your sexual fantasies. And the thing is, he would take it literally. He wouldn't see the sarcasm in that. He would say, you're welcome. You're very welcome that because you're right. I am the great one who came up with this, so you are welcome.
Hey, that is just so amazing. We're talking with Dr. Scott Bond. He is a professor and criminologist, professor at Drew University. He wrote the book, Why We Love Serial Killers, The Curious Appeal of the World's Most Savage Murderers. We're talking about, you actually sat down with Dennis Rader, BTK killer, and we're discussing why he had such a long break between killings, because that's very unusual to have that long of a break. And I can't remember how long it was, but it was years. And I remember law enforcement thinking that he had gone away. He had either died or was in prison, and then boom, he came back up again. And now we find out Dennis Rader's patting himself on the back because he figured out how to masturbate and relive, and therefore he didn't have to go out and kill again until it just didn't work anymore, I guess. And that is just absolutely fascinating. One thing I've never been able to pin down about Dennis Rader is this. His childhood. Hmm. Now, I know there's a discussion of, is a serial killer made or is a serial killer mm-hmm. born? And I believe you and I agree on this. It's a little of both. Nobody grows up in a nice, loving household and becomes a serial killer, or do they? I just feel like he has to have something in his childhood that just messed with him, that kicked in the serial killer gene or whatever the hell he had in him. And he didn't come from a perfect childhood, or did he?
Well, that's a very good question, and there's a range of opinions on whether serial killers are made or whether they're born that way, and I agree with you that it's a combination of the two. And once again, not all serial killers are the same. The motivations aren't the same. The fantasy needs are not the same. And the origin or the root of it is not the same. Now, what many of them have in common, many of them, and this is true of Jeffrey Dahmer, and it was true of David Berkowitz, the son of Sam, and it was definitely true of Dennis Rader, is in childhood they became very interested in and aroused by death, and actually would torture and kill animals, strangle cats, kill animals. In the case of Jeffrey Dahmer, what he would do is he would go into the woods and find dead animals and stick his hands inside the body cavities of dead animals and feel their internal organs and become sexually aroused. Well, Dennis Rader talked about strangling cats and becoming sexually aroused. This all happens right around puberty. And what seems to happen among a number of very, very high-profile serial killers, also including Richard Ramirez, the Night Stalker, is that somewhere right around puberty, violence, death, and sex become all intertwined and intertangled in their minds, and they find themselves becoming sexually aroused by hurting things. And that over time, from the age of 13 throughout the teens into early adulthood, this fantasy grows. It builds, it builds, it builds, it gains tension, it gains momentum until they finally reach a point, oftentimes in their early to mid-20s, where they can't take it anymore and they have to go out and actually live out their fantasies and kill someone.
And let's say, I'm assuming this, what I'm about to say is the truth, not everybody that has these fantasies turns into a serial killer. Is that right?
Absolutely. It's absolutely true. And it's particularly true of psychopaths. Now Dennis is definitely a psychopath, and that's just not only me saying that. He's been profiled, he's been studied by forensic psychologists. I spoke to the late great Hazelwood, the profiler,
Roy.
Roy Hazelwood, who died just a couple of years ago. He was a terrific man. I got to know him in the last final years of his life, and he told me, he said, "Scott, without a doubt, he is the most malignant, narcissistic psychopath I ever met in my life." He even scared the professional profilers, and so Dennis, definitely a psychopath. And what a psychopath really is. It's not a mental disease. It's not a mental illness like, for example, psychosis or schizophrenia, mm-hmm. which are categorized by mental health professionals as diseases, as mental illnesses. What psychopathy is, being a psychopath, is a personality disorder, an antisocial personality disorder for which there is no cure. And it's believed, and I'm among those who believe this, that you're born with a deficient chip. Something is wrong with the wiring in your brain, and you're born a psychopath. And those people who are born this way simply are incapable of feeling the normal range of emotions, normal emotional responses. They cannot feel true love. They cannot feel sympathy, empathy. Shame, guilt, remorse, fear. They just don't feel the normal range of emotions. They're able to be excited, agitated. They can enjoy sex, but that's physical. They don't have the normal emotional range, and that's why they're able to commit these horrific crimes, and it rolls off of them like water off a duck's back. They simply don't react in any way. And oftentimes they depersonalize, dehumanize their victims. In fact, Rader called his victims projects. They weren't human beings.
Projects.
They weren't women.
Yeah.
They were projects. And Ted Bundy called them objects. He referred to his victims as objects. And he was another psychopath. So there's this tendency to just, you know, completely objectify their victims. And so I believe that psychopaths are born, but there's approximately 1 million, we believe there's about 1 million adults in the United States out of 300 million that are psychopaths, and not all psychopaths become serial killers. In fact,
that's what I wanted to talk to you about. Yes, continue with that thought, please.
Many psychopaths actually function pretty normally in society, and many of them become very successful people because they are extremely driven, very motivated, and they don't care about stepping on people's toes or hurting people's feelings. So guess what? Many people successful in business have that tendency, or I should turn it around the other way. Many psychopaths are successful in business or other endeavors because of this goal-oriented sort of non-empathetic personality that they have.
And when you say that you believe that psychopaths are born, they have a bad chip, the bad wiring, and I absolutely agree. I've always felt that was the case. Something has to happen to them for it to kick in to become the serial killer. And that's where the violence and the sex at puberty, when all of that happens and perhaps they have other issues in their childhood, then that chip turns into the serial killer psychopath chip, not just the regular psychopath. And that's when they start on their road to become a serial killer. And like you said, I agree. I'm sure there are thousands of people very successful in business because they don't worry about having to fire people, lay people off, or do whatever they have to do to get to the top. And, you know, you would never know they were psychopath. And they're very charming, aren't they? They can be very charming.
And, well, they can be because what they're very good at doing is mimicking emotion. They learn that because they typically are, you know, at least average, if not, you know, very, very intelligent. Ted Bundy was extremely intelligent. Dennis Rader is quite intelligent. And so they learn. They learn how to mimic emotions. They know what the right thing to say is in a given situation. They know what the right feelings are. They don't actually feel them, but they're very good at mimicking them. So they can make you believe that they care about you. They can make you believe that they're really interested in your well-being when, in fact, they don't care at all. They're just trying to manipulate you.
People can call in if you'd like. We're live right now at 713-955-0606. We are talking with Dr. Scott Bond, and Dr. Bond has written a book called Why We Love Serial Killers, The Curious Appeal of the World's Most Savage Murderers. And you were talking about a psychopath. What's the difference between a psychopath and a sociopath? I've heard they're the same, and then other people say, no, they're not. What's the difference?
Mm-hmm. Okay, well, absolutely. I mean, they're even professionals, people in the criminal justice field, people in the mental health field, who will tell you that they're the same thing. I don't believe that. I believe that they're two completely different disorders, and they're categorized actually in the APA handbook on mental and psychological disorders as two separate entities. Sociopathy, or being a sociopath, I believe is a quality that is developed after birth. You're not born with being a sociopath, but that it's a matter of nurture rather than nature, if you will. And the reason I suggest this is sociopaths are different than psychopaths. Sociopaths actually can form emotional relationships with certain individuals under certain circumstances and still not care about the bulk of humanity. But, for example, they may have a favorite sister or brother or aunt or uncle with whom they are very emotionally bonded, and then the rest of the world just doesn't matter. Or maybe it's even a pet. Maybe they have just an absolute love for animals but hate people. And because these individuals have the ability under some circumstances and with certain individuals to connect and empathize, it's almost like they come in and out of it. And they, unlike psychopaths, are much more likely to be emotionally volatile. They're, sociopaths are much more likely to have mood swings. They're much more likely to have bouts of rage and anger, fly off the handle, demonstrate true volatility, whereas psychopaths are stone cold. They're just there's just no change, no variation in their affect, unless they mimic it. Whereas sociopaths tend to be very volatile. Consequently, the good news is sociopaths are easier to see coming. You can see a sociopath in your vicinity much easier than you can detect a psychopath.
What should we look out for a sociopath? And then we're going to go to a question. What should we look out for?
Sure. The tendencies are actually very similar. Both sociopaths and psychopaths are extremely narcissistic. They are interested in only their own gratification. They do not empathize with others. They're not interested in the well-being of others. They do not demonstrate remorse. The difference between the two, as I said, with a sociopath, it comes and goes, and it varies by situation, and it varies by individual. As a result, they tend to be more volatile and have mood swings, so it's just easier to detect a sociopath. Psychopaths are much, much more difficult to detect, which is why serial killers who are psychopaths, and probably at least a third, if not more, of all serial killers are psychopaths. It's why they can kill and get away with it oftentimes for a very long period of time. They just don't make mistakes. You and I would be freaking out. Our heart would be beating wildly. Our mind would be able to clear our mind. Whereas they're cool as cucumbers. They can kill and just be as cool as a cucumber.
That is very frightening. Our producer, Bessie, has a question, and let me take Bessie out of the holding area. Bessie, what is your question for Dr. Bond? Bessie, are you there? Hello?
I'm here.
There we go. Okay. Bessie, what is your question for Dr. Bond?
Well, if we can turn a little bit here, I wanted to know, Dr. Bond, how common is it for a serial killer to change his MO or her MO, in your estimation?
Should we define for the audience what an MO is, or do we?
Would you do that first?
Let's do that.
And let us know.
Okay. Yeah. Well, the MO or modus operandi is what a serial killer needs to do in order to kill. So, for example, strangulation. BTK was a strangler. That was his MO. Whereas Son of Sam, David Berkowitz, was a shooter. He used a pistol. And so the modus operandi is what an individual needs to do to commit the murder. And it tends to be consistent, but it doesn't necessarily have to be consistent. They might change. They might change the way that they apprehend an individual. For example, a serial killer might start by kidnapping and trying to tie up his captive, and over time realize that that's too difficult to tie them up. So let's start working with handcuffs because it's just much easier to utilize. So they sometimes will evolve, but it can vary. What does not vary is if a serial killer has a signature, and a signature is sort of the counterpoint of the MO. The signature is something that a serial killer does to have emotional and or sexual gratification with their victim, but it's not something that they have to do to commit the crime. So, for example, Jack the Ripper, his MO was he used a knife, but his signature was the fact that he ripped his victims. He just absolutely chopped them to pieces. He didn't have to chop them to pieces in order to kill them, but he did it because it gave him whatever, crazy high he needed. And so not every serial killer has a signature, but when they do, it tends to be consistent because it's part of their fantasy. It's part of what they live for and why they do this.
Gotcha. Thank you.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Thank you, Dr. Bond. That was a great explanation. We're learning so much tonight.
I know. I'm taking notes like I were in a class.
Exactly.
This is wonderful.
For what it's worth,
and I'll throw in a plug for the book, I explain all of this in my book, Why We Love Serial Killers. The first third of the book, in fact, is dedicated to all of the sort of nuts and bolts information that you'd ever want to know about serial killers, including their personalities and psychopaths and sociopaths and signatures and MOs and fantasies and all, all that. And again, I did it because I said to myself, if I was a sort of a budding serial killer aficionado and interested, what would I want to know? And so I tried to pack it full of all the information that I would want to know.
You certainly have. I started reading it just last night and, kind of skimmed through it for the show tonight, but I intend to read the whole thing in toto. But it's very comprehensive. You've certainly covered it all in there from what I can see.
Well, great.
Absolutely.
Thank you. There's a number of myths, too, about serial killers that I address in my book. If you ask the average person on the street, describe a serial killer, and they'll describe someone to you who probably looks and sounds a lot like Joel Rifkin, who killed 17 prostitutes in the state of New York back in the 90s. He's sort of the prototype of the loner, the 20 or 30 something year old white male who lives sort of alone, but in the woods, sort of social outcast, awkward, but doesn't bother anybody seemingly on the surface. And he's just kind of the weirdo, the local weirdo, and drives around in a pickup truck, and no one realizes he's killing, women in his spare time. And that is sort of the myth of serial killers that was brought to fame through Buffalo Bill in Silence of the Lambs. He was the fictionalized version of that, Buffalo Bill in Silence of the Lambs. And do serial killers like that exist? Absolutely, because Joel Rifkin sort of personifies that, and Joel Rifkin was the most prolific serial killer in the state of New York, 17 prostitutes that he killed, but he is by no means typical. There are serial killers of every race, creed, religious, sexual orientation out there. There are Christian serial killers. There are Jewish serial killers. There are Islamic serial killers. There are black, white, Irish, every possible combination. There are female serial killers, contrary to another myth. There are female serial killers, probably the most famous being Eileen Wuornos. Who was made famous in the movie Monster. Charlize Theron played her, a magnificent performance. There are African American serial killers, Asian serial killers. So it is by no means exclusively a white male loner thing.
However, aren't most of the serial killers, at least in the U.S., aren't most of them white men? Or no?
About 50%. About 50%.
Really?
Yeah.
Really? There was a serial killer that was just sentenced in California, just found guilty, and he was an African-American. Mm-hmm. And to me, he was like the second African-American that I could think of that had become a serial killer. But when people started to learn about serial killers, it just seemed like everybody was a white male. Serial killers have been around since, who knows, since caveman days.
I mean, if you go through, history and not just in the United States, because, the world history is a lot older than the United States, there are serial killers back, as far back as time. So it's by no means an American thing. It's just we have really given them quite a platform in the United States and really popularized the notion of serial killers. And the fictionalized accounts like Buffalo Bill, as well as the high-profile serial killers, tend to be the white males, the Ted Bundys, the Jeffrey Dahmers, et cetera. It's the minority serial killers that just don't get the same level of attention. And I'm gonna make a statement, and it may be controversial, but I firmly believe this, and I can actually support it with evidence. Is serial killers tend to kill within their own race. That means that white serial killers tend to kill white victims, and typically white women. African American serial killers typically kill African Americans, and typically African American women. Guess what? The news media is more likely to give a lot of attention when a serial killer, a white serial killer, is killing pretty young white girls or white women. It's simply the case is much more likely to become high profile. Therefore, we come to believe that the serial killers are all these white men, but it's not the reality.
Yes, and that's true. Unfortunately, if a serial killer is picking on the pretty white women, that always seems to be the top story, and it's unfortunate that it's that way. But
especially if the victims are the girls. I'm sorry?
Oh, no, please continue.
Especially if the victims are kind of the girl next door, we're much more likely to be sensitive to the victims. We have the violent serial killer who is yet to be caught here in New York, and he received quite a bit of publicity, but not the same kind of publicity that he would have received if he hadn't been focusing exclusively on prostitutes. You know, sort of injustice that happens is, well, he's killing these women, but they are prostitutes, and they're out there, and they're kind of asking for it. I mean, I'm not saying that, but that tends to be, you know, sometimes a callous approach. Whereas if he's killing the girl next door, you know, the innocent, next door neighbor, then we're more outraged. But we're not quite as outraged as a society if they're preying on prostitutes, because we kind of look at them as, well, they're a little expendable. And not that I'm not saying that I believe this, but society tends to look at it that way.
It's unfortunate, but it's the absolute truth. And I do think police departments kind of feel the same way. I mean, look at what happened with the Long Island serial killer. Not much was done.
Oh, yeah.
Finally, chief of police
was removed.
Many of the victims,
many of the girls were not even treated as missing person cases or investigated for quite a period of time because of the fact that they were sex workers.
Exactly. And that's just tragic. And hopefully that is changing as we as a society learn more and understand more about serial killers. But why is it, Dr. Scott Bond, professor at Drew University, author of the book Why We Love Serial Killers, why is it people like me, people younger than me, older than me, men, women, we all gravitate to the horrible, awful, terrible story Jeffrey Dahmer, people in those drums, people parts in his fridge? We couldn't get enough of it. And everybody that has done that, you have a twinge of guilt because you shouldn't be all over this, but you are. Why? Why can't we just say that's terrible and block it out?
Well, it's a great question, and it's one of the primary reasons that I wrote my book. And the answer is, guess what? It's not a simple answer. It's kind of multifaceted, and it's at different levels. We love the adrenaline rush. When we're kids, we love to have the bejesus scared out of us in fun houses and haunted houses and monster movies and stuff like that, because we get addicted even as kids to that adrenaline rush. Well, guess what? Serial killers give us as adults that same jolt, that same rush of adrenaline. And that's whether it's fictionalized, like in The Silence of the Lambs, or real in the case of the Long Island serial killer or Jeffrey Dahmer or whatever. And and it's also, these individuals do such extreme acts that it's almost incomprehensible to us. We can't imagine why a Jeffrey Dahmer would prey upon these young men, capture them, bring them home, have sex with them, kill them, mutilate them, and then eat them. It's hard to wrap our minds around that. And I think therein lies part of the obsession. We want to try to comprehend it. We want to try to figure it out. And of course, we can't figure it out because it's beyond explanation. Why these individuals do what they do. And in many cases, they don't know why they do what they do. I asked Dennis Rader, what can you describe your motivation? And he couldn't really explain it, but he has a term for it. He calls it Factor X. Dennis Rader calls his motivation to kill Factor X. And he said it's like an itch that just demands to be scratched. It's a need for a fix, for a high that is absolutely undeniable. And when I can't scratch that itch, I have to do it. I have to go out and kill. And nothing at all will stop me from killing. So I like to use the analogy of drug addiction, because I think it actually is a very good analogy. Try to tell a heroin addict that not to go get another fix. You know, they have to have it. And it's the same thing with a serial killer. When that urge, when it gets to its boiling point, or, you know, it comes to a peak, they have to act on it. They have no choice. And that's just the way Dennis described it. He said, when factor X, when it reaches its culmination, there is just absolutely no denying it. And I think as a society, we just find that so unbelievable that we're just so intrigued by it. And what happens is these individuals, because they're so rare, and they are rare serial killers, they get so much media attention that they become almost like boogeymen. They become larger than life. Ted Bundy, I mean, he's larger than life. And we are also attracted to larger than life things. Think about people who follow storms and hurricanes and tsunamis and earthquakes. We're fascinated by anything that is large, exotic, and deadly. Sharks. We have a shark week we celebrate, in our society. Mm-hmm. And so I think that serial killers are the human equivalent, or if human is even the right word, they're the humanoid equivalent of a great white shark. They're rare, exotic, and they're extremely deadly. And we're fascinated by that combination of facts.
Because it is something that we would never consider doing, let alone feel like we have an itch that needs to be scratched. I think that's a great way to describe it. And Dr. Bond, I agree with the comparison between a heroin addict and a serial killer. It's the same rush that they need. The heroin person, they will have to get it. They will have to, when they start to feel that itch, they have to go get heroin. If they don't care, that's why they steal, that's why they do whatever they have to. And it sounds like it's the same thing with a serial killer. Okay. Dr. Bond, you don't have to answer this question, but I actually thought of this, and now a caller has called in and wants to ask this question, and if you don't want to, just say no, okay?
Okay.
Here it is. Do you feel that Trump is maybe a psycho or a sociopath because he's highly successful but seems disconnected from people? A lot of people I know want to ask you that question, and if you don't want to step in that minefield, I don't blame you.
Well, I am not a psychologist by training, so I can't administer there are actually tests. There's a psychopath checklist which Dr. Hare, for those of you who may have done some reading about this, there is a psychopathic checklist. Where an individual will be examined, and there is multiple questions, and they score on this checklist. And depending, being a psychopath is not a yes or no thing. It's a spectrum, and some people rank very lowly, and some people rank very high on this. So somebody like Dennis Rader would rank very, very high on the psychopathic checklist. Now, I'm going to say this non-professionally because, once again, I don't administer this test. But I would say that some of the things that Trump says and his demeanor, that he seems to exhibit some of the psychopathic tendencies. So it would be interesting if he ever took that test to see how he would rank on it. But of course, he never will, or if he does, he would never divulge the results. But that's about all I can say.
Okay, well, that's good. Don't go any further than that.
It's an interesting question.
And honestly, I think a lot of people wanted to know, me included. So thank you for stepping into that minefield and not having everything explode. I appreciate that. Here's a great question for one of our callers. Do you know if a psychic has ever been successful in solving serial murders?
Great question. I've read anecdotes that they've been involved in cases, and I've heard that in some instances they've been useful in terms of leading the investigation or providing guidance in the investigation. But I'm not aware of a case that was solved as a result of a psychic. I'm not aware of one. I'm not saying it doesn't exist, but I'm not aware of one.
Okay. So let's talk a little bit about the things on your blog that you do for Psychology Today, Wicked deeds. I'm telling you, this blog, you've got to see it. How often do you publish a blog? Is it once a week? It seems like it's once a day.
No. I've been doing it for a few years now, so there's quite a library of, or I should say an archive of articles there. So if you're in a, you know, if you want to get a true crime smorgasbord, you know, you can just jump right in there, because I would say every 2 to 3 weeks. I probably average a new article every 2 to 3 weeks.
Okay, and that you can go to Dr. Bond's website, which is www.docbonn.com. And let's talk about some of the things that you have put on your blog. Fascinating. I just sit here for days and days and read about this. Why, I don't even know if you can, how can you tell if you're dealing with a psychopath? What, I think we touched on this a little bit, but let's just say you're out on a date, okay? And as a woman and as a guy, what should you look for? Because that's the worst type of person to get involved with. What exactly should you look for? Having dinner, go to a movie, and they exhibit what?
Well, if you only have one interaction, it's going to be very difficult, because these individuals are so good at mimicking the right behavior. So, assuming that you're dealing with a psychopath who has had many interactions with people, they would know what the right thing to do is on a good date or on a first date. In order to really detect a psychopath, you're probably going to have a number of interactions with them, where you begin to see that they're just completely self-devoted or self-obsessed, and that, you know, for example, if they say something that might be hurtful to someone, they show no affect whatsoever or no concern whatsoever for another person's feelings. But that's going to take time. If you're on a first date with a psychopath, it might not be so easy to determine, because they tend to be very manipulative and very good at masking their true intentions.
And you're right, that's the problem. On one date, you can't tell, but if you're getting more and more involved and you see these signs that there's nothing behind the eyes there, run, don't walk, run from that relationship, because it will be the worst thing you could ever do. Let's talk a little bit about the guilty pleasures of true crime TV. That's what you have on your Psychology Today blog. Let's face it, true crime / serial killers, big business now, right?
Oh, yeah. Actually, there have been so many of these shows that have been very, very successful on, you know, on HBO as well as on Netflix, and in fact, there's a whole network devoted to it, Discovery ID, Investigation Discovery, which I've done some consulting work in the past. So yeah, there's a huge audience out there for this stuff. So it's an indication of just how popular it is. And actually, a while back, I wrote an article for Time Magazine on that very topic, and it's this fascination with danger and with extreme danger and extreme violence. But what true crime does, what it enables us to do, true crime television, true crime shows like we're conducting right here. It allows us to get close to evil. It allows us to get close to danger and talk about it and experience it in a way, but in a fun and entertaining environment, and not a threatening or dangerous environment. You know, it's one thing to talk about serial killers. It's another thing to go, you know, spend time with one. You know, and so true crime allows us to get close to this stuff and get our adrenaline rush, without actually be putting ourselves in danger.
Something else you wrote about on your Psychology Today blog about these serial killer groupies and murderabilia collectors. Now, to me, this is just where I draw my line. That's just weird. But what do you think of those people? Are they just taking it to another step? And it's certainly not weird to them.
Yeah, it's like the true crime fan aficionado on steroids. I've talked to these people, I've interviewed these people, and they're just absolutely obsessed. There are websites out there that you can go to that are auction sites that are just completely devoted to what's referred to as murderabilia, meaning the memorabilia of killers. And you can buy everything from literally locks of Charles Manson's hair to allegedly, and I don't know how you prove it, but allegedly soil from Jeffrey Dahmer's backyard where he buried his bodies, to Ted Bundy's toenail clippings from when he was on death row because the guards collected that stuff, right? And people sell it. People buy this stuff and sell it. There are collectors, who have collections of this crazy stuff.
Okay, I'm trying not to gag when I ask this next question. Why would the guards collect Ted Bundy's toe clippings? Oh God.
Because they know there's a market for it. Because they know there's a market for it. The way that this works is, someone who's convicted of a felony, obviously a serial killer who's in prison, Dennis Rader. Dennis Rader is not able to financially benefit from his crimes in any way. So Dennis Rader cannot sell his own hair or toenail clippings, or artwork for that matter. Dennis Rader writes poetry. I've received poetry from Dennis Rader, drawings. He's actually quite a good artist, and I've received, things that he's drawn. Dennis Rader is not allowed to financially benefit from any of that stuff, but it ends up in the hands of middlemen, dealers, who will then market the stuff and benefit financially. And that's not illegal. If you just happen to own a drawing of Dennis Rader's, there's nothing to keep you from putting it on eBay or any auction site, selling it and making money on it if somebody is crazy enough to buy it. But there's something called the Son of Sam laws that was written specifically because of David Berkowitz, that prohibits these individuals from benefiting financially from their crimes. Because when Berkowitz first went to prison in 78, he was offered millions of dollars for his life story. And the state of New York and the federal government said, no way is David Berkowitz going to become a millionaire from killing people. So,
still in effect?
Oh yeah, absolutely. There's a federal law and something like 10 different states have state laws as well. I actually talk about this in my book too. I go into this. But again, if a guard smuggles this stuff out and then chooses to sell it himself or herself, there's no law against that.
Oh, that is absolutely disgusting. We're talking with Dr. Scott Bond. He is a professor at Drew University, criminologist, and also author of the book Why We Love Serial Killers, The Curious Appeal of the World's Most Savage Murderers. Okay, what kind of poetry would the BTK killer, Dennis Rader, write? Can you give us an idea? Is it flowery, love? I can't imagine him writing anything other than something just terrifying.
Yeah, well, the things that he draws and writes are completely not in tune or consistent with who he really is. He would like to think of himself as a really good guy because he in fact was the president of his Lutheran Church Association in Wichita, Kansas. He was the president. Let me say it again. He was the president of his Lutheran Church Association. So, not only is he a psychopath, he's what's referred to as compartmentalized. What he is able to do, and it's the way that these individuals rationalize their crimes. It's imagine like he had different rooms in the Dennis Rader house. One of them was the daddy room, and that's where he loved his children, or so he made them believe, and he was the good daddy. And then in another room where he was the good husband. But then there was another room in the house called the BTK killer room. And that room is where he went to when he needed to have his fix. But they're separate rooms. Mm-hmm. So in his mind, one did not cross over into the other. He was simply in the BTK room or the daddy room, and the two never, collided. So he, if you present him with this clear disjuncture and contradiction and hypocrisy, how can you be the president of your Lutheran church and then go kill people? He would say, well, it's two different mm-hmm. things. It's two entirely different things. And he would just look at you like you're crazy, like you're the crazy one.
Yeah, it is just absolutely fascinating. I wish you could have filmed it so we could see him with those looks, those incredulous looks going, why are you even asking me that question? Let's talk a little bit about the childhood here. One of the things, since I got into true crime and took over Web Sleuths and started my podcast, one of the things I'm really pushing to get people to understand is child abuse comes in all different forms. Just because mm-hmm. you weren't beaten doesn't mean you weren't abused. And mm-hmm. it seems like you can go to all of these serial killers and find out there is something funky in their life, whether it was an overprotective, religious zealot for a mother who was hung up on sex, who knows. But what can we watch out for this is a better question. How do you not create a serial killer? What shouldn't you do when raising your child?
Well, I mean, it's a great question, but it's I wish there was one thing that we could say, just don't do this and there won't be any serial killers or there won't be violent criminals. But the reality is, and there's a bigger picture here. As a criminologist, I don't just look at serial killers. I look at a whole gamut of crime, from things mm-hmm. as benign as breaking and entering, burglary, just going in and taking someone's jewelry or whatever. Not that you want that to happen, but then on the violent extreme, rape and murder and everything in between. Well, guess what? The vast majority of individuals who commit violent crime, violent and not only one violent crime, but are repeat offenders, recidivists, people who are committing crimes over and over again, not necessarily serial killers, but just committing violent crimes over and over, armed robbery, rape, attempted murder, and have a history of this and or a lifetime of these sorts mm-hmm. of crimes. These individuals come from very, very disturbed backgrounds, probably poverty, probably broken homes, probably physical, emotional, and or sexual abuse, drug addiction, everything that you can think of that is bad probably happened in that home. So, yeah, the more problematic the home is, the greater the likelihood that a child is going to grow up with serious problems. Now, having said that, and that's true of not just serial killers, but criminals in general, you look at the profile of the average person in a federal penitentiary or a maximum security state penitentiary, and you're looking at an individual who had a really messed up childhood, just 95% mm-hmm. of them in there. Now, on the other hand, there are serial killers who had pretty benign upbringings. Ted Bundy's upbringing, aside from the fact that he was adopted, was pretty benign. Same thing with David Berkowitz.
Can I just jump in about Ted Bundy? Didn't he find out when he was like 14 that his sister was really his mother, and supposedly that's what like kicked him into this anger thing against women? Am I just talking out of my mouth here and don't know?
No, you're absolutely correct, but I'm sure lots of people find something like that out, or even much worse, and don't become a serial killer, And the same thing with David Berkowitz.
Correct.
David Berkowitz was angry that he was lied to about his adoption as well. But again, not everybody who's lied to about being adopted goes out and starts hacking people up, It's an extremely an aberration. Dennis Rader had a very benign childhood. So not necessarily do these individuals all come from really, really troubled backgrounds. Now, but then on the other hand, some of them do. And one who did was mm-hmm. Ed Kemper. the so-called co-ed, co-ed killer.
Yes.
He came from an extremely – his mother was an insane alcoholic who would burn him with cigarettes and lock him in the cellar with rats. And I mean, he had a horrible childhood. So guess what? He grew up to absolutely despise his mother, not surprisingly. You know, who wouldn't after having these things done to you? But even with that, not everybody grows up to kill women because they were, you know, tormented that way.
By your mother.
So
go ahead. Please continue.
No, go ahead.
No, I was just going to say, I remember something that Kemper said, and I read it in a book, that he, when he killed his mother, he took out her larynx and threw it in the disposal, and the disposal spit it back up in his face. And he got really angry, and he said, "God, she's still talking to me, and she's dead." And he was just very, very upset. She was a crazy, awful, terrible woman. And he was a brute, man. What was he, like 6'7", and awful. I'm sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt. Please continue.
No, that's okay. That's okay. No, Ed Kemper is, you know, I mean, his life was a mess. I mean, he was really tortured as a child. Still, but he also was a genius. You know, he had a genius level IQ. And one of the interesting things about Kemper, well, I don't know if interesting is the right word, but disturbing things about his story, he was so bright, but so disturbed that his mother actually sent him away for a while when he was in his early teens to live with her parents. Kemper had already developed this, you know, this hatred toward, especially women. So guess what he did? He didn't like his grandmother very much, and at the age of 15, he shot his grandmother, killed her. And then he thought to himself, gee, when Grandpa comes home tonight, he's probably not going to be too happy about this, so I better shoot him too. So he killed both his grandparents, ended up in an asylum for the, you know, for the insane. But guess what? He was so smart that by the time he was 19, within 4 years, he basically learned how to pass all the psychological tests and was able to present himself as perfectly normal, because what he did is he broke into the psychiatrist's office at the asylum and memorized all the psychological testing, and they thought, oh, he's cured. So they let him out when he was 18. Guess what? Went home to mom, and it all started. Then he became the co-ed killer.
Oh, boy, that's fascinating. I had no idea about him breaking into the doctor's office and memorizing how to act like a normal person. That's a brilliant guy, and that's really very tragic that his mind couldn't be used for something more productive. I want to tell not just you, Dr. Bond, but the listeners out there, this is something that was told to me by a very brilliant psychologist, and I bring it up every time I can because I want people to realize this. One thing he told me, the psychologist, about child abuse, he said, you know, I can really help people who have been physically abused. It takes a long time. It's awful, but I can help them. I can help them if they've been sexually abused. He said, I can help them if they have been abused by, you know, yelling and screaming and called names, and I can help them. He said the one type of client that is almost impossible to help is the child that has been completely ignored. That ignoring the child growing up, I mean, when I'm talking ignore, not letting them realize that their opinion matters when they're little kids, you know, just ignoring them and acting like they're not there. He told me, he said, I just can't seem to help those people. So I've always really want to get that across to people. Don't ignore your kids. That, you know, don't abuse them in any way, shape, or form. But, boy, ignoring is really the hard one to deal with. And nobody looks at that as child abuse, you know, because you're, just because you're ignoring your kid doesn't mean you're abusing them. Well, you know, you kind of are. So that's just my soapbox moment. Sorry, Dr. Bond.
That's okay. I'm glad you said that. It's very important, and I totally agree with it. And One other thing that I'd like to debunk, here's another myth. You know, you talk to a lot of people on the street, and there's this assumption that if you were abused as a child, that you grow up to be automatically to become an abuser, and that's absolutely not the case. The vast majority of people who are abused as children They may develop problems as a result, but the vast majority do not grow up to become abusers themselves. It's not a good, in other words, what I'm saying is being abused is not a good predictor of who is going to become an abuser as an adult. However, if you flip it around and you look at a few people who are abusers and you look at their background, almost 100% of them have been abused. Okay? So if you are an abuser, nine times out of 10, or if not 10 times out of 10, you were abused as a child. But just because you were abused does not guarantee that you're going to become an abuser. Does that make sense?
That does make sense, and I find that really interesting because I have not heard that. That's
mm-hmm.
actually good
mm-hmm.
news that, you know, hopefully people are stopping this cycle of abuse with their own kids because it does need to stop. That's the whole point here. If crime in general, drug abuse, you've got to start with the family and the way that the child was brought up. That's just, like I said, my soapbox moment there. Dr. Bond, tell us where we can get your book, and do you have any speaking engagements coming up? Where can we meet you? Where can we corner you and sit you down and talk to you for 40 hours?
Well, thank you so much. First of all, the book, Why We Love Serial Killers, The Curious Appeal of the World's Most Savage Murderers, is available on Amazon, Barnes & Noble websites, bookstores. As you mentioned, and I appreciate you mentioning it, it's available, for example, on Amazon in both paperback as well as Kindle, and it's also available in audiobook. And I'm really proud, I'm really pleased that I actually had the number one criminology book over the holidays on Kindle on Amazon. So
that's wonderful. That's fantastic.
Yeah, thank you.
If somebody wants to get in touch with you, can they email you? I don't want them coming to your house and sitting you down for 40 hours. So if they need to get in touch with you.
Through my website, which mm-hmm. is docbonn.com, docbonn.com. You can come there and leave a comment or submit a question or something like that. And also on my blog, my Wicked Deeds blog. At Psychology Today. It's Wicked Deeds, two separate words, but it's on the Psychology Today website. You can just search for Wicked Deeds on the website, and then you can leave questions and comments there as well.
And that's on the Psychology Today website, and there's a lot of those Wicked Deeds blogs that you've done. You could spend days and days reading it. And what final comments for our listeners today, mm-hmm. Dr. Bond?
Well, I just appreciate you having me on the show, and I guess the thing that I always like to say in these situations are, you know, let's not glorify the individuals. You know, the Ted Bundy killed 36 women, and yet can any of us name the victims, the 36 innocent women that he killed, and yet
right.
Ted Bundy has become something of a rock star killer, you know, in our popular culture. So it's really mm-hmm. important to focus on the victims and as well as their families and the people left behind. And also, let's not even forget about the families of the killers themselves, because many of them go through as much hell as the victims of families. And go into seclusion. When imagine being Dennis Rader's wife and finding out that you've been living with this monster for 30 years and had no idea. You know, well, needless
Can't
to
imagine.
Say, or not surprisingly, she has gone into seclusion and disappeared.
Well, you're right, Dr. Bond. It's I've always said the worst thing that can happen is your child being killed. The second worst thing is if your child kills someone. So I'm glad
mm-hmm.
you brought that up, because a lot of people do forget, and they blame the family. And like you said, they probably didn't have any idea. I don't think anybody has heard from Dennis Rader's wife since this happened, have they? She may have made one little appearance, but she's gone.
She made one public statement. She was immediately granted a divorce. She made one quick public statement after he was apprehended, and then she disappeared. Periodically, his daughter has made public statements, particularly in the last couple of years when Rader has been promoting an autobiography that he has coming out, and his daughter's made a few statements about that. And he also has a son, an adult son, who is not who does not grant interviews. So yeah, his family really would just prefer that he, you know, just didn't exist.
And who can blame them? Dr. Scott Vaughn, thank you so much. The name of the book, Why We Love Serial Killers, The Curious Appeal of the World's Most Savage Murderers. Dr. Vaughn, you're our go-to guy now. We're going to have you on a lot, so you can't get out of it. Sorry. But thank you for coming
All right,
on. We'll be in touch very soon, okay?
Thank you so much. Take care.
You too now. Bye-bye. Bessie, are you there, my darling?
I am. That was a fascinating conversation.
Oh,
can you hear me?
Listen to yes, I can. I could listen to Dr. Vaughn for hours and hours and hours. He had a bit of a cold. Otherwise, I would have kept him for like another 2 hours. But I think he was probably getting a little annoyed. No, he wasn't getting annoyed. He's very gracious. Let's talk more about true crime, shall we? Okay, Bessie, this is going to be so cool. You know how there's Comic-Con and all of these conventions out there for
right.
every type of hobby or interest? Well, finally, somebody has come up with CrimeCon 17. That's right, CrimeCon 17. It is going to be a three-day event, the 9th, 10th, and 11th of June in Indianapolis, and you can go to CrimeCon, that's C-R-I-M-E-C-O-N, .com. You can go to their page and register. And I have great news. Web Sleuth is going to be a part of CrimeCon. And we would
yay.
Love to see you there again. It's yay. Not quite sure what we're going to be doing. We have a booth there. We're going to participate in some of the panels that they'll have. We're going to do all kinds of great things. But it's 3 days of crime and fun. You've got to go. Tickets are on sale. And here's the deal. Okay. If you go to crimecon.com and you buy your tickets, type in for the promo, type in Web Sleuths, W-E-B-S-L-E-U-T-H-S, gosh, I'm spelling everything, type in Web Sleuths and you'll get 20% off your ticket. We're going to be putting this on Web Sleuths here in the next few days, but okay, June 9th through the 11th, keep it open, we have a date, it's CrimeCon. And Bessie, have you had a chance to take a look at their website yet?
Yeah, I did, and it sounds very exciting, and I hope I can make it. I plan to be there.
Right. Well, Nancy Grace is going to be there, and
yeah.
Aphrodite Jones, and I can't wait to talk to Aphrodite Jones about her JonBenet special that she did. I think that'll be a short conversation. She'll probably turn around and have me thrown out, but Nancy Grace, Aphrodite Jones, Nurmi, we all love Nurmi from the Jodi Arias case. Kirk Nurmi is going to be there. I mean, the list goes on and on. Cheryl McCollum, our good friend Cheryl. We're going to have the Midwest Search Dogs. It's all there. And they're announcing more and more guests as the time gets closer. Web Sleuths will be put up here in the next little bit as one of the participants. So I really hope everybody goes. Don't you? It'll be a blast, don't you think?
I think so, and I anticipate there will be a large attendance once it gets, you know, becomes more publicized, because so many people are interested in true crime. So, I think there'll be a good attendance, and it should be a lot of fun and very interesting with all the different speakers.
And the list just keeps growing, and a bunch of podcasts are going to be there. We're going to do our podcast from there. I'm looking at their website. There's a million unsolved podcasts, Most Notorious, Beyond the Blood, Actual Innocence, Curiosity Kills. I could go on and on. All these podcast people will be at the CrimeCon 17. Again, that's crimecon.com. And put in Web Sleuths when you purchase your ticket and get 20% off. Okay, Miss Bessie, how you doing before we hang up? You doing okay?
I'm doing well, Tricia. How about you?
Good.
I heard you're snowed in. You're snowed in. Did I hear that correctly
literally.
In the beginning?
Yes, literally snowed in. I can't get out. I have a guy coming with a big plow tomorrow who's hopefully going to get me out. But, yeah, it's kind of creepy knowing that you can't escape. I don't know why I feel like I have to flee now that I know I can't get out. But
as claustrophobic as I am, I can't even imagine.
Yeah, it's just my car is half buried, yeah.
But again, I just, want to thank Dr. Bond for being with us, and I do have his book. I just got it last night. But skimming through it, it is very comprehensive. It's like the serial killer book of all serial killer books. It's everything you wanted to know about serial killers. So I highly, highly recommend it.
I was just sitting here thinking while you were talking, I wish I was married to Dr. Bond, but I obviously can't be because he's the perfect man. We should have a dating service for true crime people so they can hook up. Oh, my God, I'm going to make $1 million. Okay. Hey, Bessie, thank you so much. Next week we'll be back, same time, same place. By the way, everyone, Bessie does all the heavy lifting, all the hard work, and then I sit back and take all the credit. That's kind of how it works here. But thank you, Bessie, again, a wonderful producer, working hard, and I really, really appreciate it.
Thank you, Tricia. It's a lot of fun always.
Okay. We'll have fun next week, too. Good night, and we will be back same time, same place, 8 p.m. Eastern, Tuesday nights. It's Web Sleuth Radio. Everybody take care of yourself. Be safe, and we'll see you next week. Bye-bye.